I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the LRB podcast. If you subscribe to the LRB, you can get the first 12 issues for just £12. To find out more, go to lrb.me/pod. That's lrb.me/pod.
Hello, and welcome to the London Review of Books podcast. My name is Thomas Jones, and today I'm talking to Erin McLaughey, who teaches early modern European history at the University of Sheffield. Erin wrote in a recent issue of the LRB about the way the city of Florence responded to a plague epidemic in the early 17th century. We're speaking over the phone, of course, as we would have to be even if we were next door to each other, given the need for social distancing to limit the spread of COVID-19. But as it happens, we aren't next door to each other. Erin is in Sheffield, and I'm in central Italy, in Orvieto, about 100 miles south of Florence. And I've written a piece in the current issue of the LRB describing the first 15 days of the lockdown in Italy, which began 2 weeks before the lockdown in the UK. There's a strange sense I've had when talking to people in Britain that I'm speaking from the near future or to the near past, though ever less so, as the situation there comes closer to the situation here in Italy. Hello, Erin, and thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
How are things under lockdown in Sheffield?
Well, it's quite surreal, really. Quite surreal. I mean, I feel like I'm talking to a quarantine expert. Things in Sheffield, yeah, it's very strange. I mean, I'm taking my government allowed one walk a day, which is very nice. The weather has been beautiful recently, which feels like it's sort of mocking us now that we can't go outside because it's not nice very often in Sheffield. But yeah, we're muddling through.
And so to begin, why don't you just tell us briefly the story of what happened in Florence in 1629?
Sure, yeah. So the plague arrived in Europe originally in 1347 for this kind of period of epidemics. But the one in Florence began in 1629 when troops from who were fighting in Central Europe during the Thirty Years' War were kind of making their way through northern Italy. And so they were carrying with them fleas, and the fleas were carrying with them Yersinia pestis, which is the bacterium that that causes the bubonic plague. And so as they were kind of, these troops were moving around northern Europe, they were spreading the plague behind them. And it was much worse in other northern cities, sort of cities in northern Italy, initially before it arrived in Florence. It kind of came to the outskirts of Florence, sort of early summer 1630, and the deaths in the city began sort of late summer and kind of reached their height by late autumn, early winter of 1631. As more and more people started dying, obviously panic began to rise in the city, and in January of 1631, they decided, the health board in the city, known as the Sanità, decided to implement a kind of general quarantine. So everyone had to stay home for 40 days. And I think it's something that you wrote about in your piece, too, that 40 days kind of recalls the period of of Noah's flood, right? So it is sort of this really resonant period of time.
And where did the modern quarantine, that began in Venice, is that right? So after the Black Death,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. So during the Black Death, Venice decided to kind of make ships that were carrying cargo wait outside of the port for 40 days before allowing them into the city. And that's because they recognized that the Black Death really traveled with cargo, and particularly textiles and things like this, soft materials. So they decided to implement this kind of 40-day holding period.
So even though they didn't know it was fleas and rats, they did know that it was the kind of cargoes that fleas and rats would live in.
Exactly.
But did Venice ever, or any other city before Florence in 1629, have this sort of locked down the entire city in the way that Florence did? Or is that was Florence the first city to try this locking down of the whole city?
Yeah, I mean, so other cities in the 14th century and then again in the 17th century were experimenting with different degrees of lockdown, but it seems that Florence had a sense of the kind of total lockdown of the city as being a quite new invention. And they really debated whether or not to do it because they recognized that it had, a huge potential impact on the local economy. Of course, people being out of work and needing food provisioning and so forth, which is all kind of uncannily, coming back now with COVID-19. But in the 14th century, they experimented with various forms of isolation, but not to the same extent that Florence did in 1630.
Right, and because the practice of that sick people being taken apart and kept in, they call it lazaretti, is that the right word? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So that was another kind of Black Death medieval plague era invention, and it started in Venice again because they actually. The first lazaretto was on an island. They actually just used an island in the lagoon as a place to quarantine people. So that is a kind of common public health technology that emerges from the plague and continues the early modern period.
Were there doctors in the lazaretti, or were the people there looked after, or were they just pushed away and abandoned?
No, they were incredibly well looked after. So there were many plague doctors in the 17th century who were also kind of actually like medical professionals today, under particular kinds of rules because they were highly exposed. So they often had to live alone. They wore protective clothing. I mean, we all, I think, kind of know that famous plague beak, right, of the plague mask of the early modern.
Exactly, the carnival, which is a carnival character mask.
Exactly, exactly. But in the early modern period, that beak would have been stuffed with like sweet herbs and incense, which was meant to kind of filter what they thought was this sort of putrefying or corrupt air.
But presumably it did have some effects of, I mean, not in terms of purifying the air, but in terms of keeping distance and a physical barrier, it must have helped a bit, presumably. So even though their science was dodgy, the way they acted on it was...
Yeah, I mean, presumably, because it spread by fleas, and I mean, the plague's only rarely spread from human to human, right? Only when it's, I think it's pneumatic plague is the only time it's spread from human to human. So, what really is a barrier to bubonic plague transmission more than anything is isolation and distancing. Where it seems that mortality rates seem to have been highest were in high density housing, particularly like with people who were working in the textile industry and things like that.
And did the measures that they took in Florence, so if we briefly go through them, people had to stay in their houses as we do now, is that, and were they allowed out for an hour's exercise a day? Presumably not.
No. So in January, they implemented this general quarantine on the city. Women and children were actually locked in their houses first. And that was because they thought that they were sort of more vulnerable, on the one hand, but also sort of more culpable, right, that they were sort of harder to control and so might spread the disease faster. Eventually, as the kind of mortality rates were ticking up, they decided to also kind of implement this general quarantine and quarantine men too. It didn't apply to everyone. So if you were wealthy and lucky enough to have a house in the countryside, you could leave and go there. Some men, I think over the age of 12, who were working could have a health pass to go out, which I know a health pass is something that you now have to write in Italy these days too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It was somewhat uneven in the way that it was applied based on kind of class and gender. But no, you didn't have your government allowed walk once a day.
But key workers, as we're now calling them, were allowed, as you say, obviously, because if they were delivering food, there were food deliveries to every house every day. Is that right? So there must have been people.
Yeah. So there were like thousands of people who were involved in food provisioning, obviously the warehousing of food in the city, distributing it. A lot of them were members of confraternities, which were these kind of charitable lay organizations in the city who undertook these kind of, voluntary charitable roles. So, some of the, including food provisioning, transporting the sick and then so forth.
And when people fell ill, were they expected to stay at home or were they taken to the lazaretto?
Yeah, so when people fell ill, they were meant to notify a doctor who would then come to their house and certify that they were in fact ill. And they would remove the sick person to a plague hospital, which was a terrifying prospect. I mean, we know now that the Florentine plague hospitals had about a 50% mortality rate. And so people were said to fear them more than death. And I think, they did often receive quite good medical care there, but I don't think anyone would really like those odds. And then the family members in the home were then actually sort of locked up behind a barred door and kept in the home. And then often the sort of belongings in that home, so especially soft materials, cloth, bedding, mattresses, would be burned in the street. So there was always the worry that people wouldn't report plague cases because, of course, it means seeing your loved one shipped off to this quite terrifying hospital and having, your possessions potentially taken away and burned.
And obviously, as they didn't have antibiotics, they didn't actually have any treatment for the plague. It was just a question of looking after people and hoping they'd recover.
They did use medicines, like sort of different concoctions, theriac concoctions and cordials and things like that. And there was actually a great confidence in Florence that medicine worked and that doctors knew what they were doing. And that wasn't always true in other cities. So in Venice and Milan, there was a great suspicion about kind of charlatans and fake doctors. But in Florence, there seems to have been a kind of great confidence in public health.
Which must have helped with the enforcing the quarantine as well, that if the people trust the sanitar, then they're more likely to do what they ask. Yeah. And do we know why that is? Why the Florentines were more trusting of authority of doctors, or
it's really hard to know. I mean, in Milan, in the same epidemic, there were absolutely rampant rumors about what they called the untori, these kind of mysterious anointers who were said to kind of go around churches and swirl infection into the stoops that contained holy water, or they'd smear infection onto doorways and church pews. And those, became kind of part of this really like classic understanding of what the plague was like in the 17th century. But there was really very little of that in Florence. There was one doctor who is said to be either Neapolitan or Sicilian, so sort of suspiciously foreign, who was accused of poisoning his patients with rotten chickens and things like that. But that seems to really have been the only case of that.
Okay. I mean, one of the things that we've seen in some of the more unfortunate responses to COVID-19 from the Trump administration, but also from people in the street, that there's racist ideas that it's a foreign disease, that it's come from China. And that was there, I mean, you've mentioned the prejudice against Neapolitans and Sicilians, but was there any other prejudice against groups who were suspected of having brought it into the city, or were they more rational about that?
I think there are lots of prejudices. One that is actually continuous with the Black Death, the 14th century plague, is suspicion and prejudice against Jews. They were some of the first to be kind of fully locked up and quarantined. They thought that perhaps their black hat sort of festered putrefaction, festered contagion. And that was a kind of very common response in Italy at the time to be suspicious of Jews. Another population who were marginalized were prostitutes or sex workers. Sex was thought to generate excess heat in the body, which, if your kind of medical understanding is based on humoral theory, would make you more vulnerable to infection, to disease. And of course, there's also a kind of moral contagion idea there too. So prostitutes were also marginalized during plague epidemics. And then I think the poor were a kind of broad category, which is something I was kind of interested in the piece too, that there's this really interesting tension between the rhetoric against the poor on the part of the government, which often, you know, sees the poor as both vulnerable, but also as sort of essentially irresponsible, not civic minded. Even their bodies were thought to be more kind of corruptible. So one of the physicians in Florence at the time, Alessandro Righi, has a theory that the poor sort of fester plague in their bodies in a way that nobles don't. But then on the other hand, they also looked after them, and they had this kind of extensive welfare program and food provisioning, as we spoke about. So there's a kind of really interesting tension there between both blaming the poor and also looking out for them, which I was really interested in the piece.
And that is again recognizable from what's happening now. There's this that you mentioned, that people are worried that if you give people enough to eat without making them work, then they won't go back to work when you want them to. And that same, you expressed it much better than me. So you said, Rondinelli, who was one of the contemporary historian, worried that quarantine would give the poor the opportunity to be lazy and lose the desire to work, having for 40 days been provided abundantly for all their needs. And you hear Republicans in the US Congress saying almost exactly that now, and the right in the UK as well, and here in Italy.
Yeah, it's a little scary. I mean, I think, and when the Florentines were debating whether to enact this general quarantine, it was this problem of work that they really were worried about, that, you know, what would it look like to have so many people in the city unemployed and not earning, and how would we provision for that? And so kind of early on in the plague, they thought, well, we'll just give unemployed people some work, and that will kind of help them through. So they had unemployed men from the countryside, you know, working, constructing the Boboli Gardens and working in the Palazzo Pitti, building their chapel and things like that. But they got sick and died, because, of course, what vulnerable people need is not more work, but more rest, right?
Yeah, exactly. As in the way that the factories staying open and Amazon warehouses staying open and all the rest of it, which do seem to be sites of contagion now. But also that there was in the years before the plague started, isn't this right, that there was, I'm not sure, a recession is probably an anachronistic word, but there were problems in the wool market, and there was a lot of unemployment, and there were economic problems before the plague arrived.
Yeah, so there were widespread famines, there were religious wars, unemployment. As you say, like, Florence was a kind of center of the textile industry, and had already been suffering in the past kind of few decades before the plague. So there already was unemployment and hunger. So when the plague came, people were more vulnerable to disease. And that was recognized at the time. I've been thinking a lot about this in the way that people talk about COVID, that it kind of somehow reveals fractures in society that have been here all along, and that the people who we call key workers now were certainly not thought of as key workers even a month ago. I think early modern people would have really appreciated the idea that the plague is a kind of clarifying moment, right, that it reveals to us things that were previously hidden. I think that's a very early modern idea, but I see it in the newspaper every day now.
Yeah, but the people who a month ago were called low-skilled and said that they wouldn't be able to get visas to come and work in the UK are now key workers.
You're listening to the LRB podcast. If you subscribe to the LRB, you can get the first 12 issues for just £12. Go to lrb.me/pod. That's lrb.me/pod.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
In Florence, that you said that it was thought that the nobles were less susceptible. Did those assumptions change? Because presumably, were they because of social distancing or whatever the equivalent would have been, or because they were allowed to leave the city and go to their country houses? did fewer rich people die than poor people, or was everyone equally susceptible? I mean, was the plague revealed to be a social leveller, or were those class distinctions reflected in the people who suffered?
That's a really good question. I don't know the exact statistics about, or even, I don't know the exact statistics about how mortality differed. I would say that because it seems like higher mortality rates were associated with poorer neighborhoods, with high density housing, and particularly with this kind of the neighborhoods where textiles were produced, it does seem as though lower paid workers were probably had a higher mortality rate than the elite. But certainly the elite died too. I mean, I think there's a story in the piece about, I think it's the wife of the chancellor of the Sanita died. But even again, in death, you can sort of see some of that social stratification. So one of the great horrors of the early modern plague is that you would be buried in a plague pit in these kind of anonymous mass graves outside the city walls, when ordinarily, you know, in normal times, you would have been buried in your parish. But the wife of the chancellor of the Sanita was given permission to be buried in her parish church, which was, not something that ordinary people were privileged to necessarily.
But did people attend her funeral? Because it's certainly that funerals were one of the earliest things to be banned in Italy. And the idea of banning funerals still seems quite a shocking idea. But one of the focali, the epicenters of transmission early on, was a funeral. And there have been these striking and shocking images of army lorries turning up in Lombardy to take away coffins, and the stories coming from Spain of ice rinks being used as makeshift morgues, and so I think that, I mean, the practice, but also the fear of the plague pit equivalent is still with us now, and even the fact that it should be is in itself quite shocking.
Yeah, I mean, it's a horror of anonymity, isn't it, that you could just be kind of one of many. And yeah, I mean, that was something. One historian of the plague has argued that it was that horror of anonymity and the horror of the plague pit, which, you know, led people to disguise cases of the plague, right, from the government, because they just couldn't bear the thought of their loved ones being buried in a plague pit.
And the people who survived, and when they were locked in their houses, and did people keep records of what they did and how they coped with the boredom and the solitude as much as anything else?
I think, as ever, for early modern history, our best records are not always, I mean, our main records for this plague year are by elite men. Our records for how ordinary people coped mostly come from court cases, so mostly come from people who coped in ways that meant breaking the law. One of the things I absolutely loved about John Henderson's book was all of the stories that he pulled from those court cases about, you know, people chatting in the street or, doing some mending for their, you know, children, or, girls dancing together in their apartment buildings and things like that. These kind of like very ordinary ways in which, people tried to kind of break up the loneliness and the boredom, which, when I originally read that book, I thought, it's really moving, and now I kind of can't believe that we're living it.
And the story about the woman mending her son's clothes, is that right? He was in the apartment below and she lowered things on a basket.
Yeah.
But I think that was a sort of quite a standard Florentine practice for not having to go downstairs to talk to people, because in Arnold Bennett's diary from when he was in Florence in the early 20th century, he describes people lowering baskets from their windows and people in the street putting things in that they wanted and taking them back up. And actually, one of the many memes that's circulating here now shows these across a courtyard, a couple with a dog, and they lowered the dog on the lead from the balcony. And it sort of potters about on the ground beneath, and then they pull it back up by the lead.
That's amazing.
A bit dangling slightly, but quite a small dog, obviously. It's a terrier. It's slightly pathetic, dangling from its lead from its collar. Which some people react to thinking it's hilarious, and other people think it's very cruel. And of course, the other thing is that one thing that we're, I mean, this conversation that we're having now means that we're all locked in our houses, but I'm speaking to my parents far more often than I was a month or two ago. Were people still allowed to write letters? What levels of communication were permitted in Florence?
Yeah, people certainly wrote letters. There is some good evidence from these court cases, again, that people shouted to each other from their windows. Because often their front doors were actually physically barred, they would climb out their windows and go up to their balconies and just talk to each other out in the fresh air. So there are lots of ways to kind of to get around it and to talk to each other.
Yeah, and in terms of news from other places, how did the people in Florence know what was happening in Milan?
Yeah, so in the 17th century, lots of these Italian cities had their own health board, their own sanità, and they would send letters back and forth to each other, kind of reporting on the news, which is actually how Florence, of course, first became aware that there was this growing epidemic. They were getting letters from Milan, from Bologna, from Verona, kind of describing what was happening in those cities. And the early letters are really moving, really, because they're trying to work out what it is, right? And they sort of don't want to say that it is the plague, because, of course, they say that it is, then it's, hugely worrying and might kind of set off a panic. But it was a really important way for them to kind of get a sense of what was happening and sort of ready themselves, right, to prepare for the epidemic.
But they didn't actually lock down, as we haven't, until the death toll reached a certain level.
Yeah, they didn't lock down until January, and the plague had arrived in August. But what's interesting is that, so the 1630-31 epidemic kind of tailed off in early summer around May, June. But it came back again in 1632, 1633 for a much shorter period of time. And when it came back, they locked down more quickly and more extensively. So, for example, in 1630, they left the Mercato Vecchio open, the kind of main market in the city they left open. In 1633, they shut it down almost immediately. So it seems as though they learned their lesson about how quickly they need to respond, which I feel like is unfortunately a lesson we're learning now too, right?
And indeed, that countries where SARS was a bigger problem in 2003, that in South Korea and in Singapore and China and Japan, they seem to have acted much more quickly and been much more prepared and had the equipment and seem to have done a much quicker and better job at stopping it than countries that didn't have that experience with SARS. So maybe next time we'll do better too. And presumably one of the reasons they waited when the plague hit in August, that they wanted to get the harvest in before they shut down. There must have been those sorts of, I mean, partly economic, but also if you're going to shut the city and feed it 30,000 people, as it then was, you're going to need to have enough food to do that. So you're going to have to carry on those essential services, as we'd call them now. It's very hard not to use these anachronistic terms when talking about it.
I mean, I think, then as now, the prospect of really just suspending life as you know it is a huge, huge decision. And I mean, I think, as politicians now are worried about the unpopularity of the decision, I'm not sure that early modern politicians thought, or governors sort of thought, in terms of popularity, but certainly in terms of the kind of overall effect that it would have on the city and the way that they would afford it and provision for it. And it's obviously a huge decision to make.
So you've already mentioned this, but that you wrote your review before COVID-19 arrived in Europe, or before we realised that it had arrived, and the sense that you're thinking about what happened in Florence then has changed since you wrote the piece, and this, if I read the end, that you remember about the difference between, and here we go, percentages tell us something about living and dying, but they don't tell us much about survival. Florentines understood the dangers, but gambled with their lives anyway, out of boredom, desire, habit, grief. To learn what it meant to survive, we might do better to observe Maria and Camilla, the teenage sisters who dance their way through the plague year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strange feeling to write a kind of historical essay about something and then almost immediately afterwards find yourself living through something so similar. Because I think I'm constantly calibrating my own experience against what I was writing about. I mean, one of the strangest moments is when those videos of Italians singing from their balconies started to go viral. Because in Florence in 1630, they held mass on the street for people during quarantine. So the priest would kind of stand at the junction of a couple of streets on the street corner and lead everyone in singing hymns. And Rondinelli, who is a kind of elite, he was the sort of, you know, official librarian of the Grand Duke, and he wrote the kind of official history of the plague, said that it was so moving and so beautiful to kind of witness all of these people singing together. And when I first read that, I thought, well, of course he thinks it's beautiful. He's walking around on the street. He's not behind a door. And as soon as I saw those videos, I thought, I have to reassess that, because it actually is really beautiful, and is this kind of incredible moment of solidarity and collectivity. I mean, I think one of the most dislocating and kind of surreal experiences of COVID is that we are all atomized and isolated in our houses. There is no social life to speak of, and yet we are all going through the same thing. It's the strangest tension. And I think, you know, reading about the singing in Florence and then seeing the videos, I think, okay, I actually understand this now. It is not just this kind of elite man who has the freedom of the street to kind of observe what's happening behind closed doors, but actually singing is this kind of incredible moment, yeah, way of kind of expressing a collective experience that you otherwise can't do because of sort of social distancing.
Yes.
Great.
Did you feel that when you were? I mean, have you taken part in any sing along?
Yeah. Well, no. Well, actually, in Orvieto, it is very odd that there's my family and we've been out on the balcony at those times when people are supposed to get out on the balconies and there's nobody else there.
Oh, I mean, no.
It really is.
Oh, no.
So we don't have that. And it's partly, I mean, it's living in a relatively, I think, in the big cities, and you see those, you know, huge apartment block complexes in Naples and Rome and Milan and how close people are to each other.
Yeah.
We live in an apartment in a house, which there's one other apartment in that the people downstairs, and we haven't seen them, you know, and partly because we don't want to pass up on the stairs. So if they're on the stairs, we wait till they've gone in or out before we go in or out. And the stairs smell very strongly of bleach because we're not having to wash the stairs because they're washing them every day. Which and the household, I mean, that was another question, that the shape of the household now, I mean, the assumption now is of the nuclear family, although that's obviously not true for very many people. And that the question that the British government not seeming to have thought about children of separated parents, for example, or also if you have a house with several unrelated people who living together, which is, you know, a fairly common situation, people living by themselves who rely on people coming in to help them, all these situations that haven't been thought through. But what was the household in Florence in 1630? What was, as it were, the average household, or the assumed average household then?
It probably also wasn't really the nuclear family, so often extended families. So sort of multiple branches of the same family might live together in one kind of large, in the elite, within one palazzo, and they would each have kind of one section of the palazzo. Or, you know, siblings could live together. It was, yeah, often just a kind of more extended family, I think, than we are used to.
And would they be separated from each other? That if you had sort of cousins living in apartments in the same palazzo, would they be separated, or would it just be the whole palazzo would be shut down together?
I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine that if there had been a member of the household who was identified as sick, then he would be taken away to the plague hospital, and then the entire household would be kind of shut down together. I don't think they had a sense of kind of quarantine or separation within a single household in the way that we are now told to kind of isolate someone who has COVID within a space in the home.
Rich households as well presumably had a lot of servants living there. And would they'd have stayed with the families they work for, or were they sent home to their mothers, as it were? How would that have worked?
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting evidence of the servants working in the lazaretto, working in a plague hospital. So there was one servant who was working in the plague hospital, and of course, once they were working there, they had to stay there; they couldn't leave. And this woman, Maria, made it 8 days working as a servant in the plague hospital before she decided to quit. And she kind of waited for a moment when there was no one around, and she could just kind of walk out of the doors, which was obviously illegal because once you were working in a plague hospital, you had to stay there. You couldn't go home. And when she was hauled in front of the court for this, she said, well, you know, I have 2 children and I had to go home. But also I could not stay because of the great stink, which I think is a kind of interesting insight into just how tough it was to work in one of those plague hospitals.
And also part of the, I suppose, one of the most reassuring things about the story is that after 6 months, which does seem an interminable amount of time at the moment, the disease went away and people got better and there weren't any new cases. And in June 1631, people were allowed out and they came back onto the streets and into the squares and life could begin again.
Which just seems almost impossibly far away now, doesn't it? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting about the plague, this is something that the historian Julia Calvi talks about. The plague lends itself so well to history writing because there's this kind of gathering sense of tension, right, as the kind of epidemic is drawing closer, and then the tragedy, like the sort of climax of death and these kind of public health measures, and then it goes away again. And so it has this kind of natural narrative arc that makes it, such a great subject for history writing. But because of that narrative arc, you don't always think about what comes afterwards. And that's what I've been thinking about so much now. Like, what is on the other side of this? You know, does COVID change the way that we live? Does COVID change how we work, the economy? Like, what is the aftermath of this? Because of, I think, the way plague stories are told, I'm not sure that I can make any informed historical guesses.
Right. But so after in Henderson's book, he ends in June 1631, does he? That's with the end of the...
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of end of the main narrative. He has an epilogue for this kind of second shorter outbreak in 1632-33. And that's it. So we don't really know what happened afterwards. And I think, so historians, I think there was a recent paper last year that came out that tried to measure the kind of economic impact of the plague epidemic of 1630 on northern Italy. And he argued that, you know, while there was a kind of ongoing economic crisis in the decades before the plague, that the plague really was what kind of triggered northern Italy's economic decline throughout the rest of the 17th century. And it's something that I'd love to read more about because I suppose with the kind of mass unemployment and financial crash or, well, financial recession that seems to be, you know, potentially sparked by COVID. I'd like to know more about what happens after the plague year.
That seems a good point on which to end. Thank you, Erin, very much. You can read Erin's piece in the 20th of February issue of the LRB. You can read my piece in the, I think, 2nd of April issue of the LRB. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you, Erin, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The current issue also has pieces by David Runciman and William Davis on the politics of COVID-19, James Meek on the Black Death of 1348, as well as Rosa Lister on the contemporary water crises in Cape Town and Mexico City, and Julian Barnes on J.K. Weissman's. To subscribe, go to lrb.me/pod. And you can get 12 issues of the LRB for just £12.